treacherous ring roads lie ahead on our mission to reach Nana's. We must
go to Mackey's for black pepper and garlic McNuggets.
Navigation rerouting.
The main mission can wait. Take a side mission to McDonald's.
Available until the 29th of September from 11 a.m. while stocks last, subject to availability. Participation varies.
Listen up.
Huh?
That means you. Yes, you. We know you're pointing at yourself. When it comes to Paddy Power games, we've got a place made for all sorts. From the experts to the drama queens.
It's me, the GC.
The finance bros.
Look at those stocks, lads.
We'll stick with slots. It's what we're good at. And not forgetting you. Yes, you, the one listening. Because at Paddy Power Games,
we've got all sorts of games for all sorts of treacles.
Eligibility rules and terms and conditions apply. Please gamble responsibly. 18+, gambleaware.org.
Yeah, friends worked in the industry, and I said, look, you know, if anything ever comes up, I'll come and lick the floor somewhere, whatever needs doing, just to be around the cars and do stuff.
What are some of the parts on them that are worth city money? A gearbox?
200-ish.
£1,000?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
This is awkward.
Yeah. You
know, like, being ginger as well, I'm going, like, red. Like, this is really, like, I wasn't expecting this.
Hello and welcome back to the Cream Podcast, this time with another guest. We're on a bit of a roll at the moment.
We are.
Lots of guests at the moment. Now, at the beginning of every single one of these podcasts, we obviously ask ourselves, do cars rule or ruin everything around us? Actually, I should introduce the guests. I didn't think of that.
That would make sense.
I didn't think of that. We have with us Stuart from SBR Engineering. Now, some of you who watch some of the TDC content will know that that's who's been looking after Lamborghinis of mine of recent, and there's going to be some more Stuart on YouTube. But this is your first podcast.
It is, yeah. But do a lot of talking
but whenever me and Edwin have been over to SBR, we always get talking. Well, actually, this is the first time you've met Stuart, but
yeah,
you've been to, obviously, over to SBR, but whenever I've been over, we end up talking, and I'm like, God, there are so many stories.
Yeah.
Because you've got some really, really cool stories, because you've done so much in your career, not just with SBR and before that. So we will get onto that in a bit. But obviously, rules and ruins. Are you aware of what we do?
Yes,
on the front?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
now
yeah.
If, how would you summarize it? Is it a rule or a ruin for you this week?
That's a big sigh for it.
It is
to be
a big
a
sigh, because we've had some wins, okay, in the workshop, and then we've had some absolute ruins.
I mean, my car hasn't been there for a start.
That's been a win. although we have got another Murcielago with an engine coming out imminently.
Fantastic.
I'm going to go win, actually, because there's a couple of long-term jobs that didn't start off long-term, but ended up long-term,
nice,
which have, there was a lot of high-fiving yesterday in the workshop when they were done. So I'm going to go with win, I think.
For those that don't know, obviously, you can probably glean from the fact that you're working on the Murcielago, that's the sort of stuff you do. But what is your kind of bread and butter cars? What do you do? Because you do all sorts.
Yeah, I mean, primarily we're Lamborghini, Ferrari, McLaren. The offshoot of that is we've got a lot of clients that have got other cars that, you know, we do, you know, look after for them. Generally the supercar side of it. And then drift into some of the classics, because, you know, my previous, you know, places I've worked, we've done a lot of classic cars. But that's the bread and butter, the Ferrari, Lamborghini, McLaren.
The Maseratis.
Yeah, the Maseratis, yeah.
So that is part of the reason why Stuart's here. I've enticed him here with a podcast, but also said, can you please look at our Maserati? So that should, I think that might be out, or at least one of the episodes will be out on the Maseratis. So Stuart's just been and scanned the Quattroporte. We'll say no more than that. I don't know where you are with it, so we won't spoil anything. It's interesting.
It's good.
So we wanted someone who knows what they're doing to come and have a look at it. But yeah, should we do our rules and ruins? What do
no,
we have?
No,
we
I haven't, think we're because we're midweek.
Yeah, we haven't done much. Not much has happened, so don't worry about that. Again, so it's stories. That's what I'm trying to get out of you, because there's so many things. Like you told me before you drove a Speed 12 and stuff like that. You just randomly drop these things into conversation. I'm like, you need to write these things down. These need to be in a book. So that is why you're here today. We need to get through as much of that
step
as possible.
Step one.
Yeah.
So what we'll try and do is we'll try and go through your life. Not in a sort of, you know, you're sat down in an asylum type way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you said just off camera then that you kind of started off with the car stuff. With a Cobra replica.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was always into cars and, you know, reading books and top trumps and needed to know all the stats. Schoolwork probably wasn't high on my list. Well, I did okay. You know, you got good grades, but, you know, my focus was that. And so, you know, I knew all the specs of Cobras and things like that. And I managed to convince my dad when he was made redundant from his job when we came back from holiday, which was a nice letter for him to get. Managed to convince him to spend his redundancy money on building a Cobra replica.
Cause that's good.
I was always into, you know, Fords, you know, Shelby stuff, you know, GT40s, Cobras were the thing that I really
how
liked.
How old were you then?
15.
So 15,
yeah, 15.
You were building the car, you built a Cobra rep.
And there's we found pictures recently actually of me driving the car down the alleyway between the back of the houses with no body on it, sitting on a bucket with a 5 litre can with pipes just in it, you know, and all those things that you shouldn't have done, but obviously great fun, great story.
So did you go straight from that into, so you kind of knew you wanted to do something related to cars, but was that like your first job or did you do something else in between?
Ironically, I was, like I say, into Fords. Jim Clark was a bit of a, looking back, probably a bit of a hero. I used to love the Cortina, lifting the wheels and racing, and I've always wanted a Mark 1 Cortina. And I managed to convince my dad to lend me some money to buy one. And he said, well, look, you know, you're going to have to buy a welder. And you're going to have to learn and you're going to have to do all these things. And he said, look, you need a job. So I literally went and got a job and ended up repairing lawnmowers.
Nice.
Ride on tractors, that kind of thing. And yeah, just that fed the car habit. And yeah, that was my first car and twin cam engines and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, friends worked in the industry. And I said, look, you know, if anything ever comes up, I'll come and lick the floor somewhere, whatever needs doing, just to be around the cars and do stuff. And, you know, my dad said to me, look, if you're going to do something, try and specialise. You know, I would have worked in any garage, to be honest. I just like working on cars. Yeah. And the opportunity came up to work at what now is HRO in Ferrari. It was Lotus Bugatti London at the time.
It was Bugatti. And
The EB110 was cool. They were the dealership, you know, the dealership for the EB110 and Lotus, and they just went bust as I joined, which was 94, 95.
Yeah.
They'd just gone bust. So I ended up going into a workshop there as a semi-skilled apprentice, working on Lotus, TVR, Ferrari, the tail end of Bugatti with the EB110s. And that's how I got into the car stuff.
Did you ever get to drive an EB110 on that early stage? Really?
Oh, no, not at the early stage. No. That was, I mean, it was a bit of a battle getting to drive 348s, as that was the new car when I started. Well, 355 was just coming out, actually. And I remember my boss having a row with his boss, because I look really young when I was like 18. And then it's like, he shouldn't be driving these cars, you know. But that sort of came and went. And that's how I got into that level of car.
Yeah. TVRs must have been interesting. I think you mentioned TVRs a couple times. Obviously, that's 90, so it's pre-Tuscan.
Tuscans came out just as I sort of was leaving. So the Speed 6 was out. Yeah. And the Cerber, obviously, with the six-cylinder engine, but they were, the customers did a lot of R&D for TVR back then.
Yeah.
We'd collect cars, we'd get a call, out of the trucks here from Blackpool, you know, we need to go and get cars off, and there'd be eight cars on the truck, and all the techs would run down, jump in the car, and you'd put your foot on the clutch. I remember a Cerber, I wanted to put my foot on the clutch, and there's a noise when you put wow, it's a bit weird. Got the car back, and, long story short, it had, someone had put any thrust washers in the engines when they built the engine on this AJP engine.
Yeah.
And every time you put on the clutch, it was like the webs of the crank hitting the bar. It's like, wow. There's a lot of TVR fire stories as well.
I don't want to hear those.
Yeah.
Now, I can't remember how we got to the conversation when I came over before, but I mentioned a Speed 12. And then you just said, I've driven one of those. Now, a Speed 12 is not, it's not like saying I've driven a Cigares or something.
No.
That's an exceptionally rare car. Few people can say they've driven
what
it. How
weird.
Did that happen?
Yeah, that was a weird one, because when I mentioned that, you mentioned something, God, I forgot about that. And the car was at Bruntingthorpe, I think. They were restoring that Vulcan there. I don't even remember that, but aeroplane they were restoring there. And I'm sure the car was there. And we were doing something with Mazda at the time, racing when the RX-8 came out. And being car, a friend of mine said, do you want to help at the weekends? And it's like, yeah, I'll go and do that.
Yeah.
And he knew I worked on TVRs and everything. I said, we've got this car here. And I do need to do a bit of digging and find out whose car that is, because I've seen in recent years pop up online. And I think, well, is that the one that was down there in Bruntingthorpe in the corner? And it was literally, we want to try and get this thing running. He gave us a hand, got it running. And it wasn't speed runs or anything like that, but it was quite a cool thing to see. It was nowhere near finished. There was bits hanging off of it, but quite a cool thing to look at.
Finished TVR product, though.
Yeah, it's ready for the customer.
Because they didn't sell it.
No, that's what I was going to ask you if you got to have a go in it, because the famous story being that Peter Wheeler took it home one night, ready for production, drove it once and said, we cannot sell that to the public.
Yeah.
That's not allowed.
Because when they're meant to be 1,000 horsepower, yeah. one ton car, I don't know how many of those numbers are.
7 litre. I think 7 litre V12. So I think there are three cars or three chassis left of them.
Yeah. That's a company with a blueprint to like rebuild engines and stuff. Yes, but that car always felt like a myth. Yeah. We'd seen it in games. You'd see it in a game and you go, why does no one else know about this 1,000 horsepower, one ton car? Like, surely this is the fastest thing on planet Earth. And they look incredible. I used to have the Hot Wheels one, which looked different to some of the production ones. And then that car appeared at a show last year. I didn't even know it existed, with the sort of different headlights and a slightly narrower body. Yeah. But that...
There's a fantastic video. It's on YouTube of whatever the release was. I think it was the London Motor Show, of them driving it through the streets of London, the tracking car, for like 20 minutes before it got to the show. Mm. And it looks, compared to all the metro cabs and everything that's there, it looks like what I can imagine an F40 look like next to a Fiat.
I've never seen it at the show, because it was on the stand there, and I think it was revolving. I'm sure it was on the stand that was moving around. Yeah. Mm. And we were all working on, you know, Griffiths and Chimeras and stuff at the time, and we were like, this is nuts. What have they made?
Yeah.
And we were racing the Tuscans as well. It's part of being a dealership. You had to run a Tuscan, and a good friend of mine, Steve Guglielmi, who got me my job at HRO, was the driver. And... you know, Peter Wheeler, again, he was running all sorts of random engines in his car. You know, he's the boss. He can have a 10-litre Rover V8 or something in there. You know, and I kind of like that. I like that about TVR. It's like, let's have a go at this.
Yeah.
Like you say, you know, cars kept, the Cerberus, I remember PDIing one of those and coming back, it's like, really hot smell. There's something's not right on this. And it was our demonstrator. So we said, look, we need to do some more. One of the salesmen said, I'll take it home. I took it home, went into London, did a few things. Next day, car caught fire in London.
Quite hot then.
Yeah. Like really, really like went up. Yeah. And what was happening, they'd made a two-piece prop shaft and it was joined together with mastic, you know, to be like a damping prop shaft. So it is like telescopic. Well, what happened when the cats that were underneath warmed up the prop, that rubber softened and the prop shaft wound up, but consequently shortened. And as it shortened, the nose of the prop came out of the gearbox, dripping all the ATF gearbox fluid onto the cats, which caught fire. So they issued a bulletin, like, you need to recall any cars, but they've got this problem. And it was a solid prop, so you might get a bit of vibration, you might get complaints from customers, you have to monitor it. And they sent down what can only be described as guttering that went on the inside of the tunnel. So it was an upside down tunnel up the prop, and it had a crease down it, which just, if any leaks happened, it went straight down this tunnel, this duct, and out the back of the car, nowhere near the cats. And that was the fix. And,
that feels very TV.
Engineering solutions for Blackpool, you know. So.
Treacherous ring roads lie ahead on our mission to reach Nana's. We must
go to Mackey's for black pepper and garlic McNuggets.
Navigation rerouting.
The main mission can wait. Take a side mission to McDonald's.
Available until the 29th of September from 11 a.m. while stocks last, subject to availability. Participation varies.
Your next family adventure awaits at Disneyland Paris. Explore Disney Adventure World and step into frozen stories. Team up with Marvel superheroes and share unforgettable moments with Pixar friends. Enjoy a family holiday this February half term. Price example, £138 per person per night on a 4-night Disney Hotel Cheyenne and 5-day ticket package for 2 adults and 2 kids. Book now at DisneylandParis.com. Price may change at time of booking. Total price £2,202.52. Kids ages 3 to 11, 14th to 17th of February 2027 arrivals, subject to availability, excludes travel.
It's sort of, there's a crossover between that and the Italian cars, surely somewhere where it's similar. But so that was all the HRO and stuff. How long were you at HRO and for?
Up to early 2000s when I went to DK engineering from there.
So before we get onto the DK, we mentioned earlier that you have obviously bought the plane.
Oh yeah,
YEV. You bought YEV1L from HRO in it was originally an HRO in plate that went on the first ever, the Top Gear
Murcielago.
Yeah. Mm. And you said you put that on multiple cars.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'd have to sort of look at the time frame, because we had a few plates which we were always putting on, cars for press things and this, that and the other. And when you mentioned, I think I saw it come up on the podcast, I thought,
Well, I had to mention this to Will. I'm pretty sure that was one of the plates.
Because they put it on multiple different, obviously, like demonstrators, demos. But for me, it was like, because it was on that yellow car. I was like, oh, that's so cool. I'm still trying to source that car.
Yeah, if anyone knows out there where the chassis number of the car, the yellow Murcielago from the first season of Top Gear. Sorry, not the first season. It would be the Power Lap.
Three, I want to say. Season three with the yellow car. I want to say it's like 02 or 03.
And there's no information online. It's if you happen to know personally.
It's of no use.
Yeah.
I just want to know where it is. I just want to know because that car is, it's not like super important, but that's the first one I would have seen on TV. I just want to know where that car, I thought I found it recently and it wasn't that car. So yeah, I need to know where that is. It might end up that it's dead or something. I don't know. Because obviously demo cars, I'm assuming they get used quite.
Yeah. It's a good chance. Yeah.
Quite heavily, but yeah. Anyway, but the plate's there and it still exists, so that's cool.
So you mentioned, HRO and into DK Engineering.
Yeah.
I think probably about 6 months, no one who listens to the podcast would know very much about DK Engineering, but they probably do now.
Yeah, no, we've forced it, yeah.
But you were there quite early days of, you call it, the new generation of DK Engineering.
Yeah, I mean, it's changed a lot now and, you know, I'm lucky to have a good relationship and we do, you know, do things occasionally with them. But when I went over, to David, his father, I wanted to get involved in some of the older cars because, you know, being at a main dealer, it's great working on modern stuff. And obviously we had a mix with Lotus and TVR, I did a lot of good stuff with those cars, but my sort of passion was that I want to see some of the older stuff. And at the time they were doing a lot of stuff they do now, still 50s cars and race cars and things like that. I really want to get involved. And I went over to DK and the knowledge base there, even then, is second to none. David's knowledge is encyclopedic. You know, when you're into cars, about chassis numbers and that kind of thing. I just wanted to be around that, and it was a good move for me because I just enjoyed, that very different. I remember getting there and doing a cam belt service on a 355 and get it done, and it was literally done in a day and a bit. And when the cars were new, the bits went all rusty, like these things. It came apart easily. And I remember David's wife, Stuart, can I have a word in the office? And I was like, okay. So did that quite quickly, that car. Just wanted to make and you realise that, especially, and then how DK like to do stuff there. You want to make sure the finish is right, the pipe works nice, everything. And not that you threw it back together at the dealer, but, but all of a sudden, you say, actually, I quite like this. We're making sure everything lines up nicely, everything's done nicely. And it's just, that's a thing you don't see at main dealers. I mean, I don't know what it'd be like now at a main dealer, but I'm sure they're not worried about.
Probably similar.
Lining up, hose clips and making sure the engine bay's as clean as the outside, probably not on their, radar.
We've been to DK and seen the workshop in there.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And it's just, you can just see the level that everything's taken to in order, not just the expenditure, but like the level of detail. Obviously that's what you guys do as well. So,
I think this, when I started the business, part of my thing was like, I want to offer some of that maybe to people that didn't know it was available to do if you're restoring a car, you expect a car to look a certain way. But when you put your car in for a cam belt service, doing the cam cover gaskets, changing all the nuts, making it look aesthetically. Like the Italians go to a lot of trouble to make things aesthetically nice, asymmetrical, everything lines up, And it was good grounding for that. Yeah, definitely.
Now you mentioned to me, I don't know how many you can tell, but you mentioned some F40 related stories. So obviously F40 is worth a lot of money now, as you will be well aware.
Yeah.
But they were at a point where they weren't that popular, really. They weren't worth a lot of money. But and DK, they kind of specialized in F40s. They started out a while ago before they were really like trendy and whatever, doing a lot of F40 work.
Early 2000s, at any one time, there was probably at least a dozen of them around, either in the workshop or there. And you they've got a lot more now, but even back then, it was a lot. And
was it because so many were made relative to essentially other rarer Ferraris that there was just more around and they were cheaper? Is that why that was kind of a speciality that was chosen?
I think so. It's tough. The main dealers are like it now. Once a car's a few years old, they're not interested. And F40s were kind of a bit like that. Even when I was at HRO, we did do a lot of F40. Well, I say a lot. We didn't do that many. When I look back on it now, I think, probably only saw a handful in the in the years I was there. And then you go to DK and you saw those in the week, you know, at that time. And it's part of, well, we're not really interested in that car because the 360 had come out. You know, I went to Italy, did the course there for a week, got a certificate, did a 360. Like, 355 was forgotten about. Yeah. You know, they were coming in for warranty bits and, you know, their consequent services. But all of a sudden you watch the car park change. Yeah. Oh, it's all these now.
I guess 20, 25 years ago, there was much more emphasis and excitement about the new thing.
Yeah, massively.
Whereas now, because the new thing has reached a bit of a peak, everyone wants the old thing.
Yeah.
That's why we've talked about it before, where the F40, the F50, I know, like, they're still very expensive cars, but they had that point where they weren't much money in terms of, like, related to what they are now. But we won't see that again. You know, Enzos have never gone to, you know, 100 grand, 200 grand. They've always been worth really, really solid money. So it's like, there's almost like there was that golden period of, like, cars no one knew were valuable.
A 360 was more expensive than an F40 when I started a DK.
That's crazy.
It's mad, isn't it? When you think about it. And, you know, and 288 GTOs, like, no one really, I say no one wanted them. Like, no one was queuing up to buy them.
Yeah. I saw one this morning.
What?
I almost fell out of the car. I was driving along and I saw a red thing and it was a 288 GTO.
Yeah.
I was like, what the bloody
hell? Little Daily Ben on the way into
it. I've never seen one on the street before, but that was cool.
So around that time, as you say, they were around, what, £100,000 to £150,000 for an F40?
Were they a little bit more? They were probably a little bit less. I mean, in the trade at that time, they were probably, just over 100, around that sort of figure. Yeah.
Even with inflation, that's
insane. And so when Will met you and then came back and told me, he told me the story that was relayed, that I got excited even hearing secondhand, that you guys used to go over to Europe, buy them and drive them back.
Yeah, no, that happened a couple of times. Yeah. And I'd done that actually with someone I was doing a job for outside of DK. So, you know, we're just like, you know, doing private work as a mechanic, I'm not earning enough money, I'm going to work cars at the weekend. You know, all of a sudden you end up with this very small network of people. It's like, Stuart, could you come and do this? And, you know, all of a sudden you're doing things that you look back now, you think, I only had a camera phone. And there's things that I'm glad there aren't camera phones about, or to be honest, with cars. But we used to get them turning up on the backs of trucks from all over, like beaver tails almost, over coming back. And you think now, like, you wouldn't transport a car around like that, because I don't think they were blasé about it, which is kind of, that's what those cars were worth.
So what is there a story from when you went, whereabouts did you go and get them from?
Germany, usually. Germany, and it never came back from Spain in the car, but a lot of cars came out of Europe. I don't know where DK would have got some of those cars from. Probably, you know, they've dotted all over the place because, you know, in Italy, you know, the cars have quite a hard life. And, you know, by the time we get them over here, then they were never up to scratch to be a DK car. And, you know, the attention to detail, they have to be a certain way. And driving them back is, not something you do today.
No.
And, you know.
But I must have been cool, though, to drive it. I mean, I don't know what the sort of thoughts were about it.
Yeah.
It was probably different to what it is today. But driving an F40 back through Europe to come back to the UK must have been very cool.
It's weird, you know, you I think that the excitement of driving a car wears off quite quickly because it's like, oh, no radio in this. It's like the aircon's not great. Yeah, you know, there's, you know, and there's other cars as well that, you know, I've done a lot of miles with. And I was talking to someone recently about it. You know, you think the miles that we used to do in those cars, you think you wouldn't even drive them that far now. The owners don't even drive them that far. You know, it seems a little bit sacrilegious because it is just a car, isn't it?
Some of the miles you've done are things that people now look at and go, oh, it's a pity this car's got so many miles on. But you're the one that did that.
Definitely. There's definitely been a few cars like that.
Taking a few hundred grand off of the value of it.
Yeah.
So you were at DK. For how long were you at DK for?
God. So I had a little sabbatical from DK. I went to work for Pagani for a while. So
as you do.
This is another stuff. Again, this was, I was at SBR and I mentioned Pagani. He was like, oh yeah, I used to work at Pagani. I was like, what? Why have you never said this? So we'll get into that. So you worked at Pagani.
So yeah, so because the reason I mentioned it, I ended up going back to DK after. Funny enough, that was linked to an F40 as well, going back to DK. A friend of mine ended up being the importer for Pagani, and he'd bought one car, which was a demonstrator. And obviously they'd started selling cars. So that one car was the car that you saw on Top Gear, which I ended up driving actually on a couple of Top Gear sort of episodes, because ironically they couldn't get Hammond insured on the cars. It was really, you know, thinking back now, it's like, how is that? But obviously it wasn't as big as it was back then. Yeah. We look back now retrospectively, think, well, it was massive, but it wasn't really. My friend approached me and said, look, we need to PDI these cars. We haven't got a workshop. And I said, well, look, I'll have a word with David at DK and see if we can PDI the car here, which we did. And then, you know, unfortunately for sort of DK at the time, my guy said, look, we're starting this workshop. Would you do? And I thought, I can't sort of miss this opportunity to go and be involved in these cars. And yeah, so we went over to what they were establishing as the dealership, which was Eurosports Cars at the time.
Is this the one that was in Gerald's Cross?
Yes, yeah, Stoke Poachers.
Whenever I mention this to people, not like, obviously, it's quite niche, the Pagani dealer. But when I found that out, because as a kid, you saw Pagani on Top Gear.
Yeah.
You saw the blue car, that, you know, the C12, the C12S, and obviously eventually the F. And I was driving along. Well, I wasn't driving along. I was a kid. I was in the passenger seat or the back. And I drove past, and there was just like a Zonda F or something.
Yeah.
I was like, hang on a sec. That was a Zonda. Because you didn't see it anywhere.
Nah.
Yeah. And I don't know how many of them you drove, but I was on, people who will know Slough will know the Bath Road. And I was.
That's the expensive part, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I was off part Slough
with my mum, and a C12 came tanking past.
Yeah.
Like tanking past. I wish I still had the video. I took it on a crap old like camera phone, so I will never have it again. But that was my first memory of a Zonda.
Now,
and then I found out that their like base was in Gerald's Cross.
Now, is there a chance that was you tanking past then?
Possibly. Yeah. There was only three of us who really drove the cars there. And quite possibly.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So you did lots of like PDIs. So PDIs is what, a pre-delivery inspection?
Yeah. So at that time, I think we sold 10 cars into the UK.
Right.
And it was a funny one, because anyone who was into, if it was a supercar owner, had an Enzo. And they go like, why do I want this thing? You know, what is this? You know, and I can't remember what they were at the time. Price was like 270 grand or something, which might as well have been 2 million at the time. Everyone's like, what is it? You know, but then, performance, it was quite a cool thing, but it never quite got the momentum then. And we had only 10 cars. We ended up doing a lot of stuff. Did you remember MPH? They did an MPH show.
Yeah.
Which took over from like the Earl's Court Motor Show.
Yeah.
Then became Top Gear Live.
That's it. Yeah, yeah. So we got a call one day and they said, oh, look, have you got anything you could bring along? We're doing a promo thing. We're driving around London, handing out leaflets for the show. And my boss at the time, Roland, came up to me and said, oh, look, you know, these guys, I don't know how this show's going to be any good. Could you take the car along? I said, yeah, okay. So I jumped in the C12S and drove to Earl's Court from Slough, which is always an interesting drive. And I rocked up there, and there was I think it was the 350Z was the new car had come out at the time. There was a Lotus, I think a Clat done in the golf colours. There were a few, which actually turned out to be Max Cooper. So I've got out the Zonda and I've walked up to the guys and they're all just like, what the fuck? And I said, oh, they told me to bring a car along. They were saying like, God, taking the piss. Is that, like, what is that? You know, this car. And then it turned out we ended up driving around London for like most of the day, handing out leaflets for MPH show in a Zonda. And the rest of them just like, can I come out in it? What is this thing? And
so there's got to be some photos somewhere of that.
There must be. Like, we were stopping in like the banking district in Covent Garden, just handing out, literally getting moved on by the police, like, you can't park here. But then wanting to know all about the car.
We'll have to see if we can find some of those photos online, because that would be amazing to get.
I definitely have photos from, I don't think it was as early as that. I went to MPH, I think 06 and 07. I can't remember if it was an F or not, but they used to have a thing where they would, I think, because it was Clarkson, Hammond and May were like involved before it became like a Top Gear thing. And they would bring out all like the current supercars.
Yeah.
And they would drive them pretty slowly, but they'd drive around and rev them. And that was one of the first times I heard a Zonda, like the Zonda F like that. I was like, that's just unbelievable. But yeah, that's cool. But working at Pagani must have been, obviously, I guess you wouldn't have known, obviously what it is now is different. It's got a lot.
I don't understand it. You know, we did a Pagani just before we moved workshops, actually. We did a Zonda there. And the guys that were like Barry, that you've met at the workshop, and they're like,
okay, I don't get the fuss. It's like a tube rear end and a bit of carbon, but it's beautifully done.
Yeah.
But then there's other parts of it you think, it could have come out of Blackpool. But then you look at where it is now as a brand and as an icon. It's that's what you're paying for, isn't it?
I mean, we've said a few times, we reckon the Zonda will probably be F1 prices just because they're so
They've got the potential,
although the F1 is kind of a more perfect car, obviously, but the Zonda is that thing where it's like that unobtainium, you never see them. And now they're kind of, because they're starting to remake loads of them, the original ones are just going to be worth so much money.
Well, what was really weird with them is as they upgraded them, like our demonstrator, which went on to be Harry Metcalf's car, he bought one of our demonstrators. That started off as a C12, then it went back, then was S. Interesting, he came back with 0 miles on every time. And we had a thing at the time with Horacio, he's like, we can't do that.
Yeah.
Like he said, oh, this is a new car. This is the S.
It's but it's the same plate.
Same car. Yeah. And so, God knows what happened with that over
Did you ever drive the, is it La Nonna? The one?
No.
That's the one that's gone through like every iteration and been, that's the Triggers broom car.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a cool story.
Did you ever touch or work on an F1? A McLaren F1?
Yes. Yeah. So,
because they were the same at one point. There were multiple available. You could not that you couldn't give them away, but there were cars for sale.
Yeah,
and they would
sit. I remember I did. There was me and one of David's sons, Jeremy, who's now doing his own sales thing as well. I think James, who was, I think we mentioned, he was at school at the time when I was there, and we were the only guys that really drove the F cars and anything that was a little like 959s and Ford GTs, anything that was a little bit, keeps the risk sort of in one place and pressure on.
there's one scapegoat.
Well, he's the only guy who would have driven it, what's this scratch down the side, the F1, it came in, we needed brake pads. It was a customer that had a lot of other cars there. And he was quite adamant that I was the only one that drove the car. And
so you've driven an F1?
Yeah. So the car I drove was... Ray Bellum's road car.
Yes.
So the silver car. And I think he had the race car as well, but it was his road car.
Was it at the time, did it feel like a different experience, or did it just feel like doing well?
Car? And I feel really bad saying it. Having driven all of these cars at various different times, you kind of forget, was that quick? maybe it was quick. Yeah. I don't know, it's an amazing experience. The feel of those cars compared to other stuff at the time was light years ahead. Build quality, how the thing was put together was like, well, this is different gravy. This is
very different.
Yeah. And I hadn't experienced Pagani at that time. But having, then driven this one, this is quicker than an F1, isn't it? I think it is. You're kind of like questioning yourself. And, I think that was looking back, driving those sorts of cars was like, you look now, I think, well, not many people can say they've driven a 250 GTO, a 288, an F40, a 50, an Enzo, F1, all these cars. And at the time, I remember standing at a petrol station filling up a 250 GTO once, and the guy's like, oh, but you wish it was a real one, mate.
Treacherous ring roads lie ahead on our mission to reach Nana's. We must
go to Mackey's for black pepper and garlic McNuggets.
Navigation, rerouting.
The main mission can wait. Take a side mission to McDonald's.
Available until the 29th of September from 11 a.m. while stocks last, subject to availability. Participation varies.
We're surrounded by alien foes. The fate of the galaxy depends on us.
We fancy a Mackey's? There are daily offers waiting in the McDonald's app.
But the universe...
The main mission can wait. Unlock daily offers in the McDonald's app now.
18 plus app only. Different offers available each weekday and on weekends until the 27th of September. Check app for details. Subject to availability. Fees apply to delivery. One use per day.
And you're like...
Were there any of them that you didn't get to drive that you really wish you did, that you still think of like, oh, it would have been cool to drive one of those? Or have you driven
not,
at all?
Not really. I think you do. And like I say, you don't get blasé. I think being a car guy, there's been disappointments. I remember driving a 356 Speedster and being DK, it was the one from Top Gun, the one Kelly McGillis had. I thought, oh, and I always loved the Speedster. So they have a really cool car. And then I remember driving it. It's like, no, the dream shattered.
Yeah.
So that, would you say that was probably the biggest letdown or biggest disappointment?
Yeah, that and some Astons, because I used to quite like some of the Astons and some of those like big, heavy buses, and you think, this isn't as cool as I thought it'd be.
Yeah.
But yeah, on the whole, I think, you know, there's nothing looking back that I haven't, oh God, I never got to drive that, which is really fortunate. Don't you? Yeah. I don't take that for granted.
Is there any one car, or maybe a couple of cars, two or three cars, that stand out from everything you've ever driven? Or are they all kind of like melded into one? I guess when you've driven that many things, it's kind of like...
Yeah. I think as well, people forget when you drive these cars, you're always driving them from a really analytical, like, oh, the guy said he's got this rattle.
Yeah.
So you end up going on a drive and come back and you've had your ear pinned to the parcel shelf area looking for a rattle.
And you didn't get to enjoy it.
And then, yeah, and then someone says to you, what was it like driving that McLaren? It's like, I don't know, I was listening for this rattle that the guy asked
still
about.
Know what the rattle is.
Yeah. And so some of it gets a little bit spoiled from that, because I do look back and I think, oh, I wish I'd had maybe a bit better memory of driving. I'm fortunate to have done that, but you think, oh God, it wasn't quite the experience I wanted. Like the Zonda was really cool. You know, I got to do, we drove those in Germany with Andy Wallace. We were trying to get to do 200, which we couldn't get it to do. We had to lower the car, take bits off of it, trying to get it to do 200. Yeah. And you think back, you think, been very fast in some of these cars and autobahns, which some people will never ever do.
Yeah.
But I think cars that stand out, Veyron's a quite a special car, although they do feel like a really fast Bentley. Yeah. You know, that's quite a special car. But F40 is probably still my thing. You can never say, oh, I feel so comfortable in it. It's like wearing an old pair of slippers, but I do get in them and think, I know how these feel.
Yeah,
you know, we've had two in recently, and the guy dropped it off on one of the rainiest days before we had this heat wave here. And we're like, he's not going to bring it today. And then all of a sudden we heard, I think Patrick was with us that day, and he goes, there's an F40 outside, and the rain's coming in sideways. And the guy's like, yeah, no, I've got to take it out, haven't I?
That's cool.
And, that's and having driven cars, those cars in that sort of condition, you think, yes, I feel comfortable, but you're never... F40s are one of those cars that bite you when you don't expect it, because they're not managed well like modern turbo cars. But that's part of the excitement with them.
Yeah. I've only ever been in the passenger seat of one, and it was on the M4 in an average speed check.
Mm.
So I didn't get to experience
the real thrill. Yeah.
It was a real F40 experience.
50 mile an hour was exhilarating.
But that's just one of those cars that it's, because everyone always says it's like the ultimate driving car. It's the lightweight. Yeah. It feels like, everyone always uses the go-kart analogy, but everyone uses it on that as like, no, this is kind of exactly what it's like. It's just a lightweight, big V8 turbo thing, loads of lag. So yeah, that would be cool. Love to experience it properly.
I think most owners as well, first world problems. I had a customer phone me at 3 o'clock in the morning once. I think I was at DK, and he said, Stuart, I was just thinking about this. My McLaren F1, I wish the steering felt like my 288 GTO. And you know, when you're sitting there, like, and my partner at times like, whoa, I said, don't worry about it. You know, you're all on the phone. And you then have these conversations when you're like, well, we could put like the GTR rack on it, but it'd make it really heavy, slow speed, but you get a thing. And you think, what? And thinking back on it now, I think, what a conversation to be having with someone, you know? And you know, I'm on the phone to like Dean Lanzanti, like even like pit companies like Lanzanti, they weren't as big as they are now, but I'm on the phone to Dean the next day. It's like, oh, Dean, you're could you do us a rack? Yeah, no, we get you rack for that. What car is it going in? Right? What's he want to do that for? It's like, well, he wants this. And you're like, and you know, probably not even a conversation these days. You know, but it's just, interesting stuff.
Yeah.
I'm going to end up that old guy sitting around a table. Oh, I remember when. It's going to be one of those.
I drove a Pagani. Yeah.
Yeah. Of course you did. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure you did.
It's a £60 million car.
Yeah. No one drives those.
But I think that's why these stories are very cool, because back then no one was thinking about that future resale value. Like even when we were seeing them at Monterey Car Week, people drive them, but still with kid gloves. They're very gentle about things. Everything needs to be original.
Yeah.
The whole point of them was to use them and use them hard. Mm. Like there are F40s out there that have been beaten to within an inch of their life that are now like showpieces that they're like, no, you mustn't touch that too hard. Yeah. That's not what it has been used for the last 20K. It's been used, been driven for. There's no point in that.
It's a weird one, isn't it? I know we often talk about this when a car, because we've got a couple of customers that bought them still when they were, you know, sub 150 grand.
Yeah.
And they still use them. And I would as well, I think, you know, because you're, if you're not going to sell it, that £3 million ticket price is great, but if you're not going to sell it and you want to use it...
Also, they must be worth so much, even if you do use it, if you already used it.
Yeah.
Even if you do use it, there's still going to be... It can't be much cheaper than this, even if... I don't know how much, if it is with a broken engine. You told me once how much an engine was worth, and it was, I think... Is that a six-figure number?
Yeah.
What are some of the parts on them that are worth silly money? Just like, what's a headlight, for one?
Oh, the $5,000, I think. That's not bad. Yeah.
A gearbox?
200-ish.
£1,000?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
There was a used one up for sale recently for $125.
A bargain?
Yeah. But then you wonder, well, where did that come from?
What
cars?
Who's missing their gearbox? Yeah.
I think when you came to ours, we've got one that we're rebuilding an engine we're doing at the moment. And I remember saying to you at the time, it's like, yeah, that's a hard thing to replace.
Yeah.
And it's tough for us now as a business, because all of a sudden we're now phoning the insurance company saying, well, the F40's not here. That's back in storage. But we've got his engine and we've got his gearbox.
Yeah.
And that's worth more than... a few of the cars in the workshop. So all of a sudden you're insuring the fact you've got an engine there and gearboxes, which is something that would have just normally been encompassed in your insurance. But now it's like, no, you need to mention that you've got that. And where's the number? Where are you keeping it? And all that sort of stuff.
I remember, because I went into that room where you have the engine stuff. Yeah, and it was like, because it was kind of a bearish block at the time, I think.
I think heads are off and stuff.
He was like, that's an F40 engine. I was like, oh. Okay, it's just because it kind of looks like it's just an engine, really.
Yeah.
Until you see it in a car, you don't realize how special it is. And we saw one recently, one of the engine places we went to, they had a block there as well. And it was like, oh, that's just an F40 engine. I was like, oh, great. Yeah. We were trying to figure out if it's how similar it is to like a 308 or something.
Very similar. Yeah.
It's like, okay, so it's just the name in that.
Yeah.
So, Pagani, you also mentioned some of the Top Gear stuff. What was the, you did some of the driving.
That was because we're the importer and it was only selling limited amount of cars. We were doing everything, going around to those shows, like I said. And took that car to, we did a few Top Gears actually for different things. Because, it's like when you film stuff, you go there and you do some tracking shots. And but then the guy who was the SIG at the time, I think it was Perry McCarthy at the time, couldn't be there that day. So the car then had to go back to be driven. Mm. But then Pagani wanted their car to be driven, not the UK demonstrator. So you're always back, but they want someone there to support it. So you end up being backwards and forwards quite a lot. And I remember hiding behind a tyre wall with Ben Collins, who ended up being the Stig. Mm. And we like crouched under this tyre. And he's like, could you have a word with your boss? I really want to get involved in this Pagani stuff. And, because we had, at the time, a lot of people didn't realise we were actually building a car to go to Le Mans. So that's, half of the guys that were at Eurosports Cars were working on that project, and which never came to fruition. Well, not through us. It did happen, but not through
the
UK.
Was that the race cars on there?
Yes. So
I can't remember the name. Is it GT2 or GT1?
It was GT1 at the time, but it ended up going in, I think, as a invitation or something, because there was really something, the FI weren't happy with certain things on the car. It was going to be a lot of changes to make it homologate. So it went in as like the project prototype car, originally. But that project didn't happen. Ben at the time was like, you need to get me, I need a drive if you guys are doing that. And I think we were talking to David Brabham at the time and a couple of other Aston drivers. And obviously, that's when I first met David. And now he drives for us with our cars. It's all got this massive circle in the trade of things that come round again. But a lot of film stuff. I ended up going and doing what can only be described as a porn shoot with Zonda.
Nice.
So that was in London.
There are people ready with their keyboard for your next words.
Well, what happened, and I'll have to find this and I'll let you guys know, but it was like a gentleman's quarterly that went out and it was obviously naked ladies, but they wanted to have the silhouette of the lines of the Zonda. And I got this from the artistic point of view. They wanted the lines of the Zonda. They wanted the curves of the lady with it and everything else. So Stuart Gettys says, cool. You've got to go in this photo shoot. What is it?
And you're involved.
Yeah. What is it?
Dress light. You'll need to take them off.
It's going to be hot in there. And I got there and I was like, just the usual things, shoot. And it's got some sofas like this. And we're sitting there. There's just food, like buffet food. Coming. This is quite good. Music's quite cool in there. And they've got the big setup. Yeah. Like these women have come out and I'm like, okay.
Where's her clothes?
Yeah. It's like,
this is awkward. Yeah. You know, like, being ginger as well, I'm going like red. Like, this is really like, I wasn't expecting this. And it was quite tasteful. It wasn't, you know,
yeah.
you know, dodgy petrol station, blank yeah. cell magazine. It was quite tasteful, but still naked ladies in the car. But that was quite an interesting.
Okay,
wasn't that was what yeah. I thought
directly through Pagani as well?
No, that was just people that were approaching. People, I think okay, I think right. when the car was in Evo magazine and it was gathering a bit yeah. of momentum, that you know they wanted. You know, I think it was. That particular magazine was like high net worth kind of publication.
Yeah. The Pagani.
Like. I've never found it, and I have looked over the years. Like it's a, some odd Google searches yeah. going on. Well, I've got to stop this. Yeah. you know, but it'd be interesting to find that because it's out there.
Yeah,
it is out there.
Or so someone will find it.
Or it's
yeah. someone will find
or
it.
Or it's not. It was an elaborate ruse for someone to yeah. get. A Pagani Zonda and a load of naked women in the same room.
Yeah, is this some guy laughing? Yeah, like, do you remember that time? He's on a podcast. So I'm like, can you remember that time he got a Zonda in? but yeah.
Because I do remember, especially Pagani at the time felt like they were big on Top Gear. Like, they were like the, not early adopter, if you like, but they used a lot of Zondas and they loved it so yeah. much. And even now, if you go to the Pagani factory, what, the museum that they've got, they have the Top Gear magazines everywhere.
Oh, really?
So I think they yeah. must love Top Gear because it's like there are, every single cover of a magazine that's got like, or something that's related to the TV show, they have it plastered everywhere. So Top Gear are obviously, you know, in their good books. But I mean, that was the first time you saw something like that.
There's
not many new car companies that stick around.
They don't. That was unheard of, wasn't it, really?
Obviously, Koenigsegg are kind of the other one, but there's not really that many others, are there?
I think they were lucky that Hammond got behind that as that was his car, wasn't it? He was the Pagani guy. And then as the evolutions of that car came out, he was their PR guy, wasn't he? Let's face it. It's odd that that industry that, I mean, given Horacio's background, it was probably, not given, but he had the best chance of making a car that would breakthrough into the Lamborghini, you know, Ferrari sort of glitterati. He was the only guy, wasn't he?
Did you ever meet and speak with him?
We've
heard from lots of different people that he doesn't speak English when he doesn't want to. That sometimes if he speaks
really good English. He came down to Slough, which must have been a good day. In the cover under the cover of night, you know. And I remember being introduced to him for the first time. And he was like a really nice guy. And I think when you talk to those kind of people who are car guys and his design, and you talk to him about the Countach, his involvement with that, although that version might not have been everyone's favourite.
Yeah.
You talk to him about cars. It was great. But I've been around when people have approached him and you see that it's a great cover, isn't it? English. It's great.
The story with him kind of starting Pagani, because was it Countach or was it? Countach, wasn't
it? Countach, yeah.
He wanted to make carbon fiber. And he went to Lamborghini and said, you should do carbon fiber. This is like the next big thing. It's going to be lightweight, it's strong, blah, blah, blah. And I think that the quote, I don't know what the exact quote is, but the rough story is that Lamborghini said, if Ferrari aren't doing it, we don't need to do it. And obviously now they're all doing it. So it was quite ahead of the game, really. But yeah, Pagani, it does feel like that. Really kind of like legendary, like they kind of entered in as that new boy with Ferrari and Lamborghini, and now they're somewhere like almost above that.
Turned into sort of artwork pieces as haven't they? You know, you look at the presence, like you say, at Car Week, you know, and I'll have to check with James, actually. I'm sure one or a couple of those cars are probably PDI'd.
Because we didn't see one last year. I want to say we didn't see a single Zonda. And then this year was just four. Zondas. Yeah. It was actually great to sit when we saw James actually completely by chance when they were driving that F, the one that's had a few of the upgrades, and he took off down the road in it. I was like, that's what I wanted to hear.
It was a sound of, it activated a childhood memory.
Yeah.
I think it was from one of the MPH shows.
Yeah.
I was like, it was either that or Goodwood.
Yeah.
The only Goodwood I ever went to, I begged and pleaded for my parents, and I heard the noise. I was like, that's the best car noise.
Yeah. It was something else. I mean, we had so much trouble on track days trying to get it through noise. there'll be pictures somewhere. We were like cutting their bottoms off Coke cans and blocking off two of the pipes, thinking, do you know what? You know, 50% will be better, won't it? And then coming back and they've been fired off somewhere down a street somewhere for someone dodging stuff. But yeah, the sound of those things is something else.
It is cool. But you just don't see them anywhere. But yeah.
I had an EB110 collapse on me, suspension collapse on me, literally coming on boost and the front suspension came off. Interesting story. That was going back to DK after Pagani. So I went back to DK to visit.
Yeah.
And David said to me, look, could you drive this F40?
This is while you're at Pagani.
While I was at Pagani. And at that time, the dealership was actually, it wasn't going under, but they'd sold, like I said, they'd sold their allocation of cars. What we then realised was their allocation of cars. And it just wasn't working. You know, Pagani wanted us to have two demonstrators, which back then was like, you know, £500,000 plus worth of cars as demonstrators, and no one's buying cars. You know, it's not a great business model.
Was this around 2008, 2009 odd?
No, this was earlier. This would have been sort of 2002,
oh, wow.
something like that, yeah. And so one car went to Harry Metcalf. I think that's when Bob Fosner took it over. So Pagani were then in London. And in the middle of that, I went to DK saying, hi guys, how are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. David said to me, look, drive this car. We've got a problem with this F40. Blah, blah, blah. It's not boosting. Blah, blah, blah. You know, my favourite problem. Is it boosting or not? Took the car around a couple of hours. He said, I think the wastegate split. And typical Ferrari, you had to buy a whole wastegate for $5,000. You couldn't buy a diaphragm, usual sort of stuff, which I think DK then went on, which is what they sort of pioneered now with F cars remaking the stuff, you know, and in most cases better. So I drove this car and, you know, and David said, can I have a word? And I said, yeah. He goes, look, you know, the guy that's the foreman here is, you know, going off. He actually went to start his own business. Also, he reignited a business he had. And he said, look, would you consider coming back? I said, oh, you know, let me do it. But, you know, if I came back, I'd like to have a bit more of a role, you know. And sort of long story short, I ended up going back to DK as the foreman there and then sort of running the race cars, doing the Goodwillies, you know, revival things and everything else. But back into the Bugattis and everything else. And as I mentioned, I remember going out in this EB110. Oh, Stuart, you worked on these. Take this car out. It needs to do this, this, and this. And I think at the time we were getting parts from Dower because they ended up, they'd bought all the old parts and they were remaking things. And I took this car out. And one of the guys I worked with was Italian. I said, yeah, so you've got to take me out in the car. You've got to take me out in the car. And it's, it's not something you would usually do because it's not joyrides. You know, it was a sales car, but that particular car. But you know, it's like, look, as long as the boss is okay, you coming out. Let's go in the car. As it turns out, I was pleased to have someone with me because as I went up through Watford, where their old workshop went up to accelerate across this A road that was, you could open them up a little bit. There was this almighty bang, and the whole car just dove down onto the floor, front suspension skating around, and we sort of skidded to the side of the road. And one of the front lower arms had completely unfolded around the bush. The bush was still on the car, and the arm had come off completely. Jesus. And that was us at the side of the road.
Treacherous ring roads lie ahead on our mission to reach Nana's. We must
go to Mackey's for black pepper and garlic McNuggets.
Navigation rerouting.
The main mission can wait. Take a side mission to McDonald's.
Available until the 29th of September from 11 a.m. while stocks last, subject to availability. Participation varies.
Your next family adventure awaits at Disneyland Paris. Explore Disney Adventure World and step into frozen stories. Team up with Marvel superheroes and share unforgettable moments with Pixar friends. Enjoy a family holiday this February half term. Price example, £138 per person per night on a 4-night Disney Hotel Cheyenne and 5-day ticket package for 2 adults and 2 kids. Book now at DisneylandParis.com. Price may change at time of booking. Total price £2,202.52. Kids ages 3 to 11, 14th to 17th of February 2027 arrivals, subject to availability, excludes travel.
In a Bugatti?
Yeah, an EB110. It's super sport as well.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yes, and we ended up, it was, yeah, typical mechanics things. Get some ratchet straps. We'll ratchet strap the arm over. We'll get it driving and we'll get it up onto a trailer, which we did. And but looking back now, can you imagine filming that?
Yeah.
There's like loads of guys running around in, you know, T-shirts all the same. Like, what's going on here? Where these guys have come from? You know, straps under the car, trying to get on a trailer quick. You know,
boss would have seen it on Instagram before you had a chance to call him.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is what happens now, isn't it? Yeah. That would have made good content.
Even
for
before EB110s, I don't know what they were worth then. Obviously, they're worth now. But obviously, that's all pre-Veyron as well.
Yeah.
So pre-Veyron. So it's pre-Bugatti being what it kind of is today.
Yeah.
I remember seeing because the Dow on him, I never understood what that was. We used to go to Maranello and Egham quite a lot, and they had an EB110, and it was a Dower. I think it was like exposed carbon with brown or red. And I was like, "What the hell is this?"
Yeah.
I've never heard of that before. But they are really, really cool cars.
They bought a lot of chassis, and a lot of parts, and they had enough to make up enough cars.
I
want
to say it was 5.
Yeah, it was quite a small number
because it was Bugatti, then a bus company, Then the Dow bought it off the bus company. Then it went to the guys that made that weird Adonis
thing. Yeah, yeah.
And then it went back to the bus company. EV110 has been through like 15 different hands of companies, and all the chassis gets lost every time.
Yeah, yeah.
So no one knows how many total are in it. It's genuinely an amazing story.
So you've gone from you've gone from Pagani, and now you're
back at DK. So back at DK now.
And when is it? This is mid 2000s,
late 2000s? So that's early 2000s. Yeah. So I did. Yeah, I was only there for a year and a bit at Pagani before it was, like I say, that full fizzled away, and it's got perfect timing. It's like, actually, that's not quite working out. I didn't know, behind the scenes it wasn't working. And then, ended up going back to DK.
So back to DK. And how long was there anything between that and you starting up your own company? Did you work there for quite a while?
Yeah, no, I worked there up to 2008. Okay. So sort of a fair stint after. And I was getting to the point where, I've kind of done a lot of this stuff. People were asking me, look, could you do this for me? Could you do that for me? I said, I can't. It's a conflict of interest, you've got to respect where you've been before. It's such a small industry, like we've spoken before. All of a sudden, you're talking to this guy. Oh, we did this together back in, 1995. Like, did we? And, all of a sudden, there's all these things come out. And I did quite a long stint there. And, a lot more Goodwood stuff at DK, like the racing, which is quite good. We did, we had some really sort of important wins with cars that I put together there. Mm. Won the TT a couple of times with cars, and it was some really, really cool stuff. And still carried on with all the F car bits. It was kind of my area that. Then 2009, I said to them, look, I'm going to do my own thing. I ended up still working freelance for them for a bit. Mm. But then I think once I'd started doing a lot of other work, and although we weren't in direct competition, because I'd ended up doing quite a lot more modern stuff, more modern race cars, more modern bits and pieces, there was still a little bit of, quite close to them.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a mass exodus of customers, although a couple of customers did sort of come over with me. It's a small industry, and you don't want to start upsetting people. Mm. It's customers are customers. Like, well, I want you to do it. Can you do it cheaper? It doesn't matter if they've got £1 billion or, a cheap car they want to fix. Yeah. They're just like, well, could you do it for me after work?
You're closer to me.
Exactly. But I've always been respectful of that. And although, like I say, there was a little bit of friction early days, I think they then realised, like, Stuart down the road's not really going toe-to-toe with us. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And then their business really escalated. When James came out from uni and really inputted some sort of more modern bits there, with their social media, that business has just gone. I mean, it's amazing to see it now. I mean, I think if we had the means, we'd all build a business like that.
Yeah. I mean, even just the facility they've got, it's hard to explain what it is without showing it. Obviously, people see it in the photos.
Yeah,
stuff,
I don't think it does it justice.
There's a feeling about the place that you don't get anywhere else.
I think it's tough when you go off at, like when I started the business, obviously you want to aspire to being, that kind of level, which I think, when people come to us, like, wow, your workshop's really clean and this, that and the other. And I think, well, you've just brought your F40 down here. I don't want you tripping over a Maserati Gran Turismo gearbox on the way in or something like that,
I think TDC.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I think there's a misconception of, you're a specialist. You're not the main dealer, so it's going to be cheap and it's going to be a bit, dark, dingy place, and you're not fitting original parts and all that kind of thing, which, you just couldn't get away with. I don't think people ever did. I think they've obviously been spurious characters over the years. Mm. But I think when you've worked in that kind of background and that kind of ethos, it was very easy for me to go, well, that's how I like doing things. Let's try and do it myself.
Yeah.
And not been easy.
I was going to say, you did start your business, that's right on financial crisis. Was that any?
It wasn't the greatest move, I've got to be honest. I think it's, looking back on it now, I think you kind of blank it off in your mind because it's like, it was so tough. You just blanked out. It's like,
this is a blurry
vision. Don't
even
remember. Yeah. And people have asked me last year, how did you do it? And I think, I don't know. I really don't know tips. And I think long and short of it is having some really good friends.
Yeah.
Some people I've met over the years. There's a guy, Nigel Chilton Hunt, who I owe quite a lot to because he gave me the opportunity to start my business in a barn at his house. Mm. And, you know, he's got an F40, he's got other things. And he said, look, if you can help me out with some of my cars, I can offer you a bit of space. You can do a few bits. He pointed a few people to me, like, oh, you know Stuart, you know, you know his background. And it sort of went from there. And you know, I started that in 2009. I did have a little foray with some other guys and we tried to do a bit of a thing. It never quite works out when you've got some guys have got the money, some guys have got the experience, who's doing all the work.
Yeah.
So I ended up doing it on my own. With the help, you know, of friends. And, you know, before I knew it, I had a Zonderef in that barn. I had a Marine Zonderef in there. I saw a picture of that recently with like a 250 Lusso park next to it and a 430 Challenge car, which was quite new at the time. And Barry, who I met at DK. So, yeah. You know, I've known, you know, Barry now for 25 years. And, you know, he turned up at mine one day when I just started, not long after I started. He said, look, you know, I'm thinking of leaving DK and want to do something else. And I said, mate, I've got enough work for me.
Mm.
But next week I've got a Testarossa coming out. I'm going to need a hand getting the engine out.
Yeah.
And I think he'd kind of left and he was doing little bits with friends in the industry as well, like helping out. And he came over and helped me. I think it was September 2009. And he's been with me ever since.
I've never realized he's been there that long.
Yeah.
Barry's great. That was the first time I came to you. Obviously, I remember hearing about you guys from Paul Wallace.
Mm.
And even just Googling it, you were 20 minutes down the road.
So
you were like the local thing for me. And but I'd never met Barry because obviously Barry wasn't that, you didn't like doing any of the camera stuff before.
Yeah.
And it was obviously the Gallardo at the time. And you said like, what Barry doesn't know about Gallardo is just not worth knowing.
I
found it out like immediately. Yeah. It was like 20 minutes in. It was like, yeah, well, your clutch is buggered. You need this. You need this. I was like, okay, this is, I don't like this news, but at least we've got to there quickly.
Yeah. Barry's, he's very much a dying breed in the mechanical industry. Mm. I think, yeah, there's very few people at that sort of knowledgeable, sort of, you know, he probably wouldn't use the word passionate, but he is. And you need those people when you've got a small team. You know, there's like, you know, there's only five of us there in that business, but we've all got very good background of what we've done. And, you know, when he came over to me, he's like, come do whatever you need doing, you know, and, you know, we could be 1 minute fixing a leak on the roof. We're up ladders on the roof. And then the next minute, you know, you're taking the engine out of, an F50 or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's that knowledge base, which I think's helped the business over the years. Because, you know, initially you start with, I think I had £500 in my bank account and I'm like scrounging a bit of space off a customer in his barn, which was really good, you know, and obviously he got a benefit. You know, I was doing his cars next to bugger all. But yeah, building that up at a time, I think it's a good grounding because the financial crisis was there.
Mm.
And what helped us at the time is people didn't want to pay loads of money. People were getting out of cars. They were like, you know, they were either financed to the hilt, they wanted to get rid of them, or they were like, well, if I keep it now, I've got to keep it.
Yeah.
I'm going to get the wheels done. I'm going to get that big service done. I'll get that leak that they've been telling me for the last 3 years that the main dealer I've had, I'm going to get that done because I've got to look after this thing. And I think that worked well for us then.
Will told me a story that at some point that there's potentially, it was an F40, that secured your building later on.
Yeah, so it was, once again, I think it was about 6 or 7 cars that we looked after sort of regularly.
Mm.
And it was when the F40s were going up, you know, they were like, 1 minute, this was 2009-10, one of the customers bought one on a whim at a Goodwill auction and he paid £215,000 for it in 2009. And the market probably would have worn 250 and he really wanted to get out of this car. And I said, well, look, put it up for 225. You've made a little bit of money, blah, blah, blah. No one wanted this car. And Jeremy, who was the salesman at DK at that time, who I spent a lot of time with, you know, I did the Meal Amelia with Jeremy. We spent, you know, hours in cars together over the years. And he's like, mate, you've got to take your F40 off. He goes, we've got two and we can't sell it. I said, well, why don't you take one of yours off? And we have one each up for sale. And I think that car sold for 215 in the end, but we had a battle to sell this car. And then as we went on, you know, we moved premises, we moved to Watford. That's where I met Paul. He helped us with a bit of social stuff. And yeah. I'm like, hey, what's this Instagram about? Yeah. And I was like, I might as well open the window and shout out, I've got Ferrari in here. Yeah. Like, what's it about? And, you know, yeah. look where we are now. But as we went on with the business, yeah, these cars went on and we got into selling them. And we do broker them and sell them now. We only sell cars that we know. And we ended up selling the car, brokering the deal. That car then got sold again. And yeah, the money we ended up earning ended up being the deposit to buy the unit that we're in now.
Yeah.
And all that sounds great. It wasn't hundreds of thousands, but it was money that for a small business was quite hard to find in a lump. And my dad passed away in COVID, but he was always a bit of a mentor with money and stuff like that. He's like, you know, look, you make your own luck, you know, if you're not there doing these things.
Yeah.
We were there doing it. We sold a couple of cars and it's like, all of a sudden we got a bigger unit. And we got this. And then think, how are we going to fill this up? And then cut to, you know, 6 months later. Need more space. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, you know, it's
the,
just like
the universal rule of cars. If there is a space, you can fill it with more cars.
Yeah. So yeah, it's, I look back on it and think, yeah, starting with no money was a good way of doing it.
Yeah.
You know, don't get me wrong. There's been times when I'm at home thinking, someone would just give me some money to do this.
I guess it's the journey that makes you appreciate where you're kind of at now. You can now look at the journey rather than starting at where you're at now. And then I think it's normally better that way.
I think so. And I think I'm very old school. I think, you know, if someone came into me and said, shit, it's £500,000, I want to invest in your business.
Mm.
What would you do with it? I'd probably go, I don't know. You know, I put it, it looks good in the bank. You know, what, you know, my naivety at the time, I don't know. You know, would I have gone and bought a business? You hear so many stories and there's so many things even going on now. You think, well, that poor guy's invested all that money and that's gone tits up.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't ever want to be that guy involved in that. So the struggle was, I think, worth it.
Yeah.
It was a struggle. Yeah. But still getting to work on cool cars. So sometimes in the evening when you're borderline tearing up, you're like, got an F40 in the workshop. Yeah.
Well, it was something we were saying off camera just before we started is that most people in your position right now would have done the legwork for 5-10 years, even less, and then gone, cool, I'll sit in the office now and I'll let you guys do it.
Yeah.
But you like still working on the cars.
I do, yeah. I mean, I was 50 this year and the glasses are now need to come out. Oh, God, this is good. Because when you're in the footwell looking at wire, what colour's that wire? And like Barry shouting across the workshop some abuse as to, hey, can't see the bloody thing, you know, and he'd climb in over me like, you've met me. Let me do it. No. But I still enjoy that. And I think, you know, it's hard. It'd be hard for me to sit in the office. I do spend one day a week in the office going, shit, I wish I was just doing stuff in the workshop. Yeah. But it's got to be done.
Yeah, of course.
And I think it's hard to find people that have got the experience as well in the industry.
Mm.
The work ethic, I think, is the big one.
Yeah.
I think the work ethic is not easy.
Yeah, we get that with Ben.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen him earlier on.
And Patrick.
Like, yeah. Pat. Oh, yeah, don't get me started on that guy. Yeah.
Now, do you, obviously, you've showed us some of the cars that you own. I don't know how many of them are sort of personal cars.
Mm.
How many cars have you got now?
Of my own?
Yeah, because obviously I'm aware that you work with such like really, really cool cars.
Mm.
You often, when we speak to someone like you who works with cars like that all the time, they often don't have anything. They're like, oh, this is my daily. It's a diesel this.
Yeah.
But because they're around cool cars all the time, they don't ever own anything personally. But do you own anything personally at the moment?
Treacherous ring roads lie ahead on our mission to reach Nana's. We must
go to Mackey's for black pepper and garlic McNuggets.
Navigation rerouting.
The main mission can wait. Take a side mission to McDonald's.
Available until the 29th of September from 11 a.m. while stocks last, subject to availability. Participation varies.
A few 10 years ago, I bought my first brand new car, which was a BMW M4. And for me, I'd won the lottery. You see, I think you know what it's like. You know, you're working on things like, I'd really love one of those, And I have other nice cars, you know, but when they were worth nothing, like E30 M3s, I had five of those.
Jesus.
And
what did you pay on each of those, roughly?
I didn't pay more than $5,000 for any of them.
That's the dream.
Yeah, not more than $5,000. And I think I said to you off camera earlier, I'd love another one because I just love those cars.
Yeah.
You can thrash the life out of them and you won't get in trouble like you would this other stuff. Yeah. But I just can't pay that much money for one. So yeah, I bought an M4, which I still got.
I was going to say, 10 years I've had
that car, yeah.
And it's a cool spec also.
Do you have a, what colour is the interior on that car?
So it's black with tan.
I was going to say, because it's the spec you don't see on an M4 that often. Did you spec that?
So that was a car, connections again, isn't it? I was dealing with a customer who owned most of the BMW dealerships inside the M25.
Yeah.
And I said to him, oh, I'd really like one of those. If I could get it on a decent finance deal, I'd buy that. Buy one, I think. You know, if I've made a few quid, I'll buy a good car, you know, not think of, let's save. you know that one.
Yes.
And I spoke to him. He said, look, there's a car here. He goes, you could change the spec, but we need to know, like, literally the next 48 hours, because it was a car that's been like a cancel order.
Yeah.
And it was going into, I think, Boreham Wood BMW I bought it from. And he said, it's black with it. You might not have black with tan. I thought, no, I quite like that. Because they're usually red or black or everything else. Yeah. And he said, it's a competition. Not everyone wants those. So it's got like the holes in the back of the seats. And this is before they started putting competition on the back.
Yeah. Oh, it's really late.
So it's just black badges.
Yeah.
And I said, I quite like the sound of that. So I said, yeah. And yeah, I ended up buying it. But I ended up getting one of these really good deals on finance, which turned out to be like what they offered footballers, or like, as it turns out, sort of you YouTuber guys, these good deals you get.
I haven't found those yet.
I was going to say, if you could let me know where those are.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And what I should have done, the thinking man would have gone, I could own this for 2 years and not lose any money. And that didn't happen.
Yeah, no. So 10 years later, it's still
lost. How many miles is it now then?
56.
Oh, so you haven't done like huge miles in it.
I had like an E91 touring 3 litre, diesel with the DPF off of it and all the usual stuff. And that was the daily car.
Yeah.
Then got rid of that because, ULEZ and bought a Cat S Audi estate and fixed that. So it doesn't matter.
I love to hear that.
Yeah.
That's TDC born and bred.
And I bought that car. And I thought, this is nice. It's got really, compared to the BMW, it was like brand new car. And it was a 2021 rich car. Still kept the BM apart. I kept telling, and everyone keeps saying, you keep saying you're going to sell the M4. So it's still there. And I used it today, actually. It's the first time I've been used in like 8 weeks. Oh, I've got to take that for a run. But it was, 6 years ago, my now fiance, and she was always like, why didn't you have one of these cars? And probably shouldn't I? I probably should get a car.
Because you can look after one.
Yeah. And I ended up buying a 355.
Yeah.
Which I've only just sold recently, a car I said I wouldn't sell.
This is the race car.
Yeah, so a challenge spec car, which I raced for 2 seasons. Got a few trophies won, which is quite good.
Yeah.
Ended up racing it against clients though, so you're like
having to break across the finish line and let them win.
It never quite got to that, but I got very close. And for me, it was like, do you know what? That's like ticked. Never thought I'd own a Ferrari. I PDI'd those when I was at HR Rally.
Yeah, that's cool.
Got to race one. I'm like, and some people appreciate this. Yeah, I pulled up, took the crash helmet off, and the thing is like, I just raced a Ferrari I own and everything else. And I think sometimes when you're busy building a business, trying to do stuff, you don't quite take it all in and think, actually, because sometimes you sit there and think, I haven't quite made it. I see these guys on social media have done all this stuff and they've got all these things. And then you think, well, no, actually, in my own ways, I've done more than any of these guys are going to do. So, sold the 355. Got a Lotus Cortina.
The Cortina I've seen.
That's very cool.
Yeah, Mark 1 Lotus Cortina. It's an FIA car, a 1965 car. Been all around the world. It's raced in New Zealand in period.
Yeah.
190E.
Now these are interesting.
The 190, so the 190, because I turned up at your unit again, Mercy Lager related. I'm not starting things, and there was a 190E in there, and it's a 2.5, isn't it?
Yes,
which is like the more rare version
manual
of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which we've recently found out that Francis Bourgeois, new Grand Tour.
Yes, so I saw that.
You've both got one.
He's got one. He said his is a.
It's a late two.
It's still got a Cosworth head, not a Mercedes head.
Yeah,
I don't know if you know anything about. I didn't know anything.
Yeah, it's a casting thing.
Okay. But you've got that now. That has an interesting story behind it.
That was
I don't know how much you can say about it before someone comes
up.
So
it's an interesting car. It came, I can't remember who it was, even on Facebook, I think.
Yeah.
Facebook or eBay, something like that. And I had one years ago. I bought it as a project and converted it into being a touring car, German touring car. So wide arches, don't laugh, 3D scanned a 360 engine, ended up mocking that up into the car. This was having a 360 challenge car engine in, did this project.
So for those listening, that's a Ferrari 360 challenge engine in a Mercedes 190E.
Yeah.
And you guys, did that.
So that car, it never got entirely finished, as in full done, signed off. I think like most things in life, I think COVID, it was when COVID hit. We're all looking at bounce back loans and it's like, I need some money. I put the car on Race Cars Direct. I don't want to do this. And, you know, getting grief off of Barry, like, you ever going to finish that car? Sitting in the workshop, we're sitting next to a Bizzarini that we had as a project to that stall as well. Cause the guy was like, oh, no one's got any money. Guy bought it in the middle of COVID. Yeah. It was in a sea container. It was on a boat and it was gone. And I'm like, and having always had the E30s and I love that era of touring car. I thought, why doesn't the 190 get much love?
Yeah.
And I always sort of vowed I'd get one.
Mm.
And this car, cut to years later. So to this year, this car came up. Well, that's quite cool. Hasn't done a lot. Looked at the MOT history. Turned out it had a really bad repair on the back. It had been recorded as having a repair. Really weirdly, but not categorized.
Yeah.
Well, this is odd. But it's kind of pre-checks when it was done in the 90s. Yeah. So it's on there. I thought, I'm not that bothered. I'll repair it properly and document it. I thought, I'll go and have a look at this car. Anyway, we drove away to Bristol, looked at this car, got it back. And the guy said, it's got some really odd stuff in the history. He said, there's not much service history. He said, but there's really odd things. There's like divorce letters in there.
Feels like the M140.
Which was also from Bristol.
Interesting.
Okay. Something in the water there.
Sorry, and it turned out the car would come from like St. Ives, Cambridge Way.
Yeah.
And it's a divorce letter in there and this really weird handwritten letter. He said, I can't make head nor tail of it. It's like, it looks like someone's in prison. And okay, really weird. I'm thinking this is not the sort of history I was looking for the car. I'm looking for, where was the service? Who owned it? I don't know, what's going on? Yeah. And so anyway, bought the car and got it back to the workshop. And Jesu liked the sales. He said, mate, let me have a look at this letter. So he's like, it's three A4 pages, handwritten, both sides.
Wow.
A really long letter. And it turns out, we think, a letter to a son from his father who was in prison.
Nice.
And reading between the lines, I think the family probably got into a lot of grief that they shouldn't have done and liked a bit of making a name for themselves. The number plate on the car alluded to him being one of the names around the estate,
right?
Should we say?
Yeah.
And we just did a bit of Googling. It turns out that someone in the family had committed ABH with tin goods in a carrier bag, which
tin goods in a car as a weapon.
Yeah, I think they it was spam, something like that in there.
It's not funny. And it's funny,
and we're reading it. And you know when you read something on the local gazette, it's like, they really use that as the line, you know. It's literally spam attack in a thing. And you read it, Jesus Christ, someone's really got in trouble here.
Yeah.
And when you're looking through it, like you say, you're instantly thinking, you're laughing about this story. Then you're reading through like, God,
Previous owner.
But it's like you guys know from the cars you've bought, like some really interesting histories with these cars.
It's an interesting piece of history to leave with the car.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. When you're going through a history, I mean, maybe he got scooted off to prison, before he could go through the paperwork.
Yeah, yeah.
But you'd normally go, I'll separate that from everything.
That's probably not car relevant.
I'll do like oil services here. Prison letters over here.
Because there's nothing in it talking about the car.
Yeah.
But then when you look at the names that the car was registered under and everything else, same nuts.
Maybe one of them wants to know.
I
want them to know what kind of guy I was.
And, Well, I think we after a little bit more, because you go down this rabbit hole, you think, what are we doing? We're supposed to be fixing cars. Yeah. We were at lunch break in the middle of doing our little detectives.
Yeah.
And I think it's obviously got sold off whilst these people were at the... Her Majesty's pleasure at the time. And the car's got, and this paperwork was just, that's the paperwork for the car. Interesting story with that car. I've got a little plan for that one. I think,
You're thinking, you mentioned ITBs before.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah. That's cool. But do you want to leave it looking relatively?
Oh, yeah. I'm toying with going with the Evo 1 body kit.
I love that.
Because I like that era. I like that amount of arch without the I like the E30 box arches because it's all integral. But I think the the stick-on bits look a little bit too. And I know it was all aero-proven, and it was, you know, it was a proper thing. But when you look at those cars with the Evo stuff, they're all underfloor as well.
Mm.
There's a lot of stuff that goes with that kit.
Trying to stick a body kit, you know.
Yeah, well, you could for the aesthetics, but
we've seen a few where people have done kits, and it's like, I'm sure if you look underneath, there's probably a 50 mil spacer in there.
People in Birmingham will tell you you can do that.
So hopefully that project will, come
I'm
on.
Looking forward to that.
I have heard many times that there is a container full of Ferrari 550 parts.
Mm.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, we've got those.
I need that.
First
I'm going to need a car, and then I'm going to need to go in and raid that.
But where's their selling off fast, actually? Because I think with...
No!
We've got like wings and dashboards and loads of bits of like wheels. Like you need a winter set of tires. I've got wheels, you know.
Yeah,
we ended up buying up a lot of parts from a company that converted, a lot of 550s. There was just a load of
converted
bits.
Them into like race cars? Or?
No, so they RML, who they built the short wheelbase thing. So
retro looking.
Yeah, we were approached by them. They sold a lot of stuff of when they first did the project to people like Eurospares and other places like that. And they kept a lot of other good stuff because there were a couple of cars left over they wanted spares for, but it just got to the point that we're having to clear out.
Yeah.
We went up there and bought all the bits. And, you know, one of those things, you put it on a show and go, why have we just put all this stuff?
I guess in the long run.
None of us have even got on a 550.
So perhaps you could build a 550 from scratch.
That's what I'm thinking. I just need to find a shell. And then
if you've got one that's been in a front ender, I can help.
Jeremy, mate, come on now.
Get on the phone. But you've obviously been speaking to Stuart saying, like, as soon as you see one that comes up,
just tell
me. Let me know.
If there is one.
So, yeah, we do get the odd. Sometimes we get a message, someone goes, I've got a 550. It's perfect. I want 185,000
pounds. Sounds like a prime car to cut up.
So that's your personal cars. Have you ever been tempted by anything Ferrari, Lamborghini since obviously like the 355 or before that? Or is it all kind of because you deal with them all the time, you don't really want to?
I find it hard to justify owning one of those as a road car.
Mm.
Only as much, I think, once again, sport, driving all the cars over the years, I think, what do I do with it? And weirdly, one of our customers was poking a bit of fun the other day with my 355 that I sold. He said, Stuart, all you've done is work on that car and get everything lovely and make everything look nice. And I turned around and said, I think I enjoyed that more than racing it. And it's hard for some people to sort of, you sold a 355 manual, why didn't you keep that? It's like, well, actually, I enjoyed the journey.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit like my Gallardo, the GT3 car I've got. I bought that when they were worth not a lot of money, thinking, that'd be good. Needs an engine rebuild, needs some bits. It's like, they've now like quadrupled in value.
Mm.
I'm like, what am I going to do with that?
Yeah.
But I know I'll enjoy putting it back together, getting the original livery because it was a British GT car in period. Yeah. And all of a sudden you're like, I quite enjoy that. And they'll be like, well, that'll probably go. But I just, in answer to that, owning a road car, I just don't know what I'd do with it.
So you're more of a race car, motorsport.
I like the motorsport side of it. But then, my Cortina is a motorsport car, but it's road registered. So it's great to drive to Mr. Scramble or something like that, because it's not highly strung, not mega valuable. And I love it, and I get people come in the workshop. I was like, is that a Lotus Cortina? And you just walk past a 40 and, a 296 race car and then walk straight to the car.
Yeah.
Lotus Cortina feels like one of those, it's like a 182 trophy. Where regardless of, even though it's nowhere near the sort of echelons of higher car, it doesn't matter if you own a McLaren F1, you go, oh, that's cool.
As soon as you see the green stripe, it's like, that's a Lotus Cortina.
Yeah.
And everyone wants to talk about that car. So they are really, really cool. But I remember the first time seeing that in your workshop and I did the same thing.
Yeah.
And it was just, even in Mercy Largo on the left and there was a Cortina, I was like, holy shit. That's a Lotus Cortina. And you said, that's yours. I was like,
we're surrounded by alien foes. The fate of the galaxy depends on us.
We fancy a Mackey's. There are daily offers waiting in the McDonald's app.
But the universe...
The main mission can wait. Unlock daily offers in the McDonald's app now. 18 plus app only. Different offers available each weekday and on weekends until the 27th of September. Check app for details. Subject to availability. Fees apply to delivery. One use per day.
I do like the race car. I think that's just where I've migrated with, the cars come up. It's like, oh God, I might take a chance on that.
Mm.
But, you know, like I've always done, you know, and I, you know, I said to the guys, you know, it rolls into the next one. Like the money that I've made on the 355, it's paid for the Cortina. And, you know, when that goes on, it goes that because it's, and I like doing that because it's, you feel like you've achieved a little win. It's a little win. And, you know, and as much as my partner goes, but you still paid that money for the other car, didn't you?
That money is
gone. But no, you don't understand. The money I made on this one's paid for it.
It's essentially free.
Yeah. But, and they're like, but you still had to pay for it.
Yeah,
but I didn't have to find that money.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It was there.
It makes sense to us.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's the long and short of it.
It all makes sense. It really does. Now, on the race car stuff, you mentioned, again, a sort of blasé offhand comment that you drive a 917K or attempted to drive one, in fact. Is this the hill climb or is this
the track?
This
was a Festival of Speed, years ago, yeah.
So you... were meant to
the psychedelic
drive.
Car. You would have, it's purple and green. Yeah. Bobby Rahal owned it, I think, prior to the customer.
So is that one of the magnesium chassis cars? Or is that the, because there was one year
not
of...
Not sure on that car.
Okay. But either way, a car that is, well, essentially a museum piece now.
Oh, yeah. I've seen pictures of it around. I have not seen it out.
Yeah.
And then you think, man, I've driven that.
So it was a 917K that you, but it there was a problem with it when you went up.
Yeah,
tried
that
to go up the hill.
That car. I think it was the press day. So, and it was longer. Obviously, there weren't live streamers of YouTubers and stuff like that. And it was one of these kind of, and it happened. And people don't understand. People, these things happen in the car trade.
Yeah,
it's like the guy's not here. Can you drive it?
Yeah.
Okay. And then all of a sudden you're driving these cars and you know, a little bit like I said, mentioned the Mille Miglia. I ended up doing the Mille Miglia in a 250 TR, a pontoon wing TR.
Crazy.
And, you know, driving from Brescia down to Rome in this car, like poking out the top of it. And you look at it and you think, what's happening here? And it turned out the guy couldn't drive the car, but he said, look, you spent all this time restoring it. This was at DK. You spent all the time restoring it. Would you and Jeremy, I mentioned earlier, the boss's son, would you drive it for me?
What was the rough value then, do you know?
I think they were a couple of million then.
Right.
And so now, I have no idea what they are. They're tens of, aren't they? They've got to be.
Yeah.
I think there's you might have seen the picture of me and Jeremy in my office driving that car.
Oh, is it? I haven't seen that.
Yeah, yeah. There's a picture on the wall and there's these two guys hanging out the top with, and that's a picture of us on the Mille Miglia.
And that is, that's just ridiculous.
That's crazy.
But the 917, it didn't go up the hill.
So that was, I get your embarrassment, you know, when you get somewhere and you...
Something doesn't start.
But that was a...
There's a crowd.
And luckily, it worked, I think, on the subsequent days.
So you have done the Goodwood Hill climb. Is it only in that car or other cars?
No,
before?
only in that.
But still,
thing.
That's not many...
And it was weird. I think then it was... The press day was, I would say, not as big as it is now. I don't even think it was over as many days. So this was a 2000, something early 2000 again when I was back there.
The weekdays used to be the days, the couple of times I went when I was younger, the weekdays, they were like not as busy.
Mm.
It'd be like day off school or like whatever it would end up being to get there. But they were the cool days because there was no one around.
And it's weird, like I did it recently. We've got a GT40 we look after, which is chassis 1001. So it's like the oldest GT40. It's technically the oldest production car because the first one was destroyed. And one of our clients said to me, look, can you take it to a festival? I didn't get to drive it, sadly, although I did push for that. Because once again, you know, boyhood dream, AC Cobra, GT40.
Yeah.
I'm done now. Tick them all off.
That was another one of those stories where Stuart told me. He's like, oh, that's just like the first GT40. Like, real one.
Yeah.
Like, but he just said it like as if it's like we're talking about. That's the microcar outside. Yeah. That's our £4,000 Quattroporte. But you've just done some mad stuff. It seems like just saying yes to things and just saying, yeah, I'll do that. Or like, I'll be a part of that. And just like meeting new people. It seems you've done so much stuff.
At the time, you think, I'm in the wrong place at the wrong time. I've now been, you know, talked into doing this. But you look back and you think, oh, actually, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
To end, we actually have a lot of younger people that listen to the podcast that are like aspiring to get into mechanics, into that sort of stuff. Now, obviously, you got your start in a different time to what it is now.
Yeah.
But what would your advice be to anyone that wants to go into that field, but not only that, wants to do kind of follow that same sort of road where they're going after enthusiast cars or sports cars or hypercars? Is there anything that you've seen in the industry or even recently?
Yeah, I think,
as a boss now.
Yeah, recent years. You know, one of the lads that works with us now came through the Bicester Heritage. They do like a, it's not a scheme, they've got their own college on site there. And the guys that are going there have got an interest in classic cars, you know, pre-war stuff, maybe coach building. And they, for us, it was getting people with the right mindset, you know, like people who are into cars. Because I get lots of CVs come through like daily. We've got a thing on our website. People want to get involved. Mm. And you can't be too brutal. You try and reply and it's like, what experience you've got? What do you want to do? And it's tough. You know, like the main dealers now have got an apprenticeship program. When I started, didn't. You know, I went straight into the dealership because my best friend was the foreman. And he said, look, we've got an opening. Would you come down? He knew that I was good. And, you know, I don't think that's entirely unachievable now, but I think you need to put yourself out there.
Yeah.
You know, we've got a guy that comes and does photos for us and he knocks on the door one day and he was doing stuff for his uni portfolio on photography. And you just like the way he approached us. And it was like, this is what I want to do. Done some really good stuff. And all of a sudden he's taking pictures of, you know, £100,000 worth of cars for his portfolio. We've got some really nice pictures for our website. And I think that goes a long way. And it tells you a lot about people. And I think, you know, if you are enthusiastic, it shows. Mm. The Bicester Heritage, there's a few other sort of colleges out there that are trying to specialise. The Motorsport College at Silverstone, that gives a good grounding. You know, we get a lot of people come from that work. We are sometimes at the race circuit, so they'll come and, you know, do a bit of work experience, that kind of thing. It's not easy. I like to say it was, you know, I hate saying it's a different time, makes you sound like a real old fart, but you know, it's just put yourself out there.
Yeah.
And the enthusiasm, you know, the guy that turns up and starts reading off specs to me about cars that I don't know, is like, okay.
There's value there.
Yeah. There's value. Yeah, there is. There genuinely is.
Yeah.
And you know, but you know, sadly, sometimes they know more of that than the doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes they're really good with the doing, but no, you know, and it's finding that balance. But I think, you know, it does show.
When we were at, funnily enough, when we were at DK, when they invited us for their kind of like tour, we were speaking to a guy who works there, one of the guys that was working, he was doing the R8 GT conversion. I'm very sorry I've forgotten your name. He does listen to the podcast. And I asked him, how did you get your job here, out of interest? Mm. And he said, I think it was a Beetle that was horrible and rotten. And he rebuilt it with what he could when he was 17 or 18 and took it to a show. And one of the guys that works at DK came over, started talking about it. He explained what he had done, essentially cobbled the car together. Yeah. And they said, you sound like you're enthusiastic and you've got the right mindset enough.
Yeah.
Do you want to learn how to do it on the cars that we work on? And now he works there doing R8 GT manual conversions and stuff. Like that's very, very cool. Just having the want to, you don't have to be working on Quattroportes or Ferraris or anything. You can be working on a K11 micro that you bought for 100 quid.
Yeah.
As long as there's that want, you can show that off and people will usually reciprocate.
Well, I early days, people was like, I can't believe you used to work on lawnmowers and now you're working at a Ferrari dealership.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, one that was, you know, having friends there helps, but unless you can do the stuff, you know, he knew I built a Cobra in my dad's garage when I was 15. He knew that I used to race radio controlled cars and I understood about setting up suspension and doing that. And it sounds geeky, but those are the people that when they come to me now and say, oh, I race radio controls and I know about this. And you think, actually, you've got that background that, you know, you want to see.
It's not as simple as having like, you can't just go, I have this qualification, therefore I have to get this job.
Yeah.
It might work out like that, but
you have to
kind of do the left field stuff, do a bit different, meet, you know, we found it with how we've ended up doing the jobs that we're now doing. That is not you don't just do that by doing a sort of a predicted path of doing it. You kind of have to go, well, I might try this out and I'm going to be, but as long as you're passionate and enthusiastic about it, I think it normally comes across.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, 100%. He does lack enthusiasm.
He does. He does some of our social media work with us, and he also works with Stuart at SBR. Sometimes.
Sneaky. I'll say that. He came with us to film.
Yeah,
at SBR. So this is just for you, Patrick. So everyone else is switching off. And then about a few days later, he was like, "Yeah, I'm going to be working with the guys at SBR." I was like, "You are welcome, Patrick. Yeah. You really are welcome."
And thank you.
Yeah. I'll wait till you get on his bad side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that was good. I mean, there are probably a million more stories to go through. So we'll, the more we talk to you, and the more we'll be seeing you more.
I think there might need to be another podcast maybe at SPR next time.
Yeah,
100%, perhaps when we can have a 550 and the Murcielago behind each other.
Both then engines out.
Yeah.
Both owned by yourselves.
Please.
There'll be many, many more stories, I'm sure. But thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks on the podcast. We've been trying to get this done for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Ever since I sort of brought the Collado over and you kept telling stories, I was like, you need to be on a podcast at some point.
Stop speaking. We need to record
this. just store that. Write that down. There's even things I can remember, like can't remember. You've probably spoken about that we should do, but we'll get to that.
We'll get a little list together, maybe.
Yeah, you need to everything you
see what
of
I
it,
can write, definitely share and what I can't.
Yeah. Write it down. Yeah. So obviously, people can find you Instagram, your website, SBR Engineering.
Yeah, yeah.
Typing in that, we'll bring it all up. Supercar stuff. That's your thing.
We've got a really good social media guy now, so
that remains to be seen.
That's what he said. He was really good. So.
But to be fair, I mean, I think I said to you before, and obviously with Patrick, that it would be good to see more of you guys on.
Yeah, because you guys do manual conversions. You do all sorts of weird
stuff.
We
do a lot of stuff. We've had a conversation recently with some other guys, and they said, "Well, why don't you put more stuff out?" And it's really hard. I built the business on word of mouth.
Mm. Yeah.
And for me, that was always the best way to build stuff. So me going out and trying to plug myself on social media always felt really alien. Mm. So we've got a good following. We've got 20,000 followers, I think, on Instagram because people like looking at pictures of cars. But we just need a little bit more now, which is what we're doing with the sales. And, you know, hopefully this new guy is going to help out.
Yeah, hopefully.
Do a little bit, yeah.
No, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers, guys.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll see you again. Thank you very much for listening.
See you. Episode, is it going to be 100?
It might be episode 100, but not sure.
I can't remember that. Either way, thank you very much for listening. We will see you next week. As always, cream get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, y'all.
Bye-bye.